Welcome to the National Council of Supervisors of Mathematics, NCSM, Leadership in Mathematics podcast. NCSM is an organization supporting mathematics education leadership at the school, district, college, university, state, province, and national levels. Its membership constitutes an international force collaborating to achieve excellence in mathematics education. Be sure to visit the NCSM website at mathedleadership.org. Welcome to episode 30 in the series of podcasts recorded at the NCSM annual meetings. This session was recorded April 21, 2009 in Washington, D.C. The title of the session is Becoming a Prime Stage 2 and 3 Leader, Understanding and Knowing the Power of Our Leadership Influence, and was presented by Timothy Canold, NCSM President. The Stage 2 Prime Leader must become skilled at influencing others toward best practice behaviors. This session provides 6 specific leadership behaviors for each step of the influence process. Based upon the influence research, learn how to make a change not only achievable and sustainable, but inevitable. Be sure to tune in to future episodes of the NCSM Leadership and Mathematics podcasts.
There's a definition of leader that I came across a few years ago. That definition reads, a leader is a person you choose to follow to a place where you haven't been before. It is with great pleasure that I introduce Tim Canold, outgoing president of NCSM and dynamic leader, who is here to influence us this morning on the and has influenced the direction of this organization for the past 2 years. Tim?
Well, first of all, thank you, Diana. That was very nice. Those were very kind words. We're working hard, and we're really excited that you're here. And I have to tell you, even as I prepared this presentation, I'm always like amazed anybody comes. You know, like, because even the title, you're looking and you're going, okay, that's really what I want to spend an hour kind of thinking about. You know, my influence, and do I have any? Don't I have any? What's it about? Is it important? Is it not important? But I have to tell you that the genesis of this talk actually started about 2 hours after I gave the presentation on Prime. And how many of you were there for the opening session then? Yeah, and if you weren't there, you missed a great session. But when the Prime Leadership Framework sort of, you know, I got up there and I said, look, you know, we must defend these 12 teachable actions. And as soon as I finished that, you know, I was like, wow, you know, first of all, is that even in our knowledge base to be able to know how to do that? And two, how do we actually influence other people towards the things that we really believe in? You know, I mean, I don't think for most of you in this room, you don't agree with those 12 things. But the question is, you are working with a lot of people who don't. You are in a sphere of influence with a lot of people who don't. And so the question becomes for us as leaders, how do we just do that? And it really started me on a journey for about a past year of looking up and researching a lot of the leadership research. And I'm actually going to reference this book. I have its picture on the screen. It was helpful, this book on influencing and the research behind it, at kind of even helping my understanding. And I've never talked about this before. This is my first try at this stuff I've been thinking about for about a year. So we may be here till noon. I don't know. So we'll see what happens. As you might recall, the Prime document actually has 3 stages of leadership. Now, I did not know it at the time that we developed the document. I hadn't read this most recent research. So it's interesting to me how closely we came to being about the right things. It's amazing. I'm like, oh, we must have been, what were we doing? We must have had something right. Because one of the things that we're going to look at this morning in this kind of sphere of influence and research on influencing others is the critical importance of us being credible in our own knowledge about what those things are. Yeah, and the search on our part to make sure we are credible that way. And then, of course, this kind of leadership of others part just stinks because it's like it's you can't rest if not everyone on your sphere of influence list isn't also doing the things they're supposed to be doing. If the teacher actions don't also match what you said we have to become about. So it just becomes, and adults are messy people. It's so much easier to influence children. So much easier. Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, like kids, you can influence, you know, like you can influence a 9-year-old. You can just tell them anything and they're like, okay. When our youngest daughter, who was in sixth grade last year, her teacher was, she was still in our elementary school, was K-6. It was still elementary school. Her sixth grade teacher, his name was Mr. V. He was like the truth. You know, there was no wisdom we had as parents that could have possibly overruled Mr. V. You know, so it was kind of interesting to me that, you know, kids, and I'm like thinking, man, he just has all this influence on her. But it's harder with adults, you know, a lot harder to figure out how do we influence and what actually works. So there's a couple of questions we're going to look at. Number one, does our primary tool for influencing others really work? And the answer to this is going to be yes and no. And then two, how do you, as a teacher and leader, grow into and sustain a positive state of influence with others? And we'll just look at three things. We really don't have time to kind of get into all of it. So we'll look at a couple of these ideas. So is influential leadership really important? How much does it really matter if a school leader is inspiring and influential in their work life? How much does that matter? So here's what I'd like you to do. Just kind of guess at this. Like if you had a vertical axis with 0 at the bottom and 100% at the top, where would you put your X? Like, oh, it matters about 70%, you know, to have a leader that you're working with or for even you to influence others at a certain level. Like, or maybe it matters 80% or maybe it only matters 30%. It really doesn't even matter at all. You know, it really doesn't matter if we're influencing others or not. That'd be 10% or something. So where would you put your X? And you have exactly 30 seconds to talk to somebody and tell them where you're going to put your X. Okay, go. Where would you do that? Okay. 30 seconds is up. Now, here's what's interesting. Sociologists, there's actually reports that say that even the most introverted individual influences over 10,000 people in their lifetime. And you're probably not the most introverted audience. But even if you are, some of us lead in a more quiet way. And then, of course, there's this whole question about, you know, in our sort of sphere of influence that I like to talk about, you know, that we all have this both personal and professional sphere of influence. And it has nothing to do with positional authority. It has nothing to do with, like, what your role is in the school district. It strictly has to do with who's around you the most every single day. And how are you influencing them one way or the other, good or bad? Or not. Speaking the truth, in fact, Kuzes and Posner in a great book called A Leader's Legacy say, speaking the truth, for each individual, the most important leader is not the superintendent. I was superintendent for 7 years. I can tell you that's true. It's the leader we see most often, the one we turn to when we need guidance, accountability, and support. Whether your title is team leader, coach, teacher, staff member, parent, district coordinator, minister, department chair, you are the most important leader in your organization for those people who are closest to you, who are looking to you, who are looking to be influenced by you. Of course, the problem, you know, we all make choices about who we will allow to influence us or not, who we will kind of listen to or not based on certain things. And it's just interesting to me that it's the people closest to the action. I have to tell you, actually, when I kind of left the classroom and the division kind of department chairmanship sort of thing I was in and became superintendent, I often thought everyone else in the organization had more influence than I did. You know, because they were like closest to where the real action was. Well, to these kids, I think they'd like your X to be pretty high. Yeah. This picture is actually was from a major newspaper a couple of years ago, 2 years ago now. But in this picture, what I find just interesting about it is that it's actually a pretty good teacher, pretty nice guy. Came into education late from engineering because he wanted to influence kids. This is the back row of the classroom. I could show you some other pictures of it. I won't. But the reality is, I'm not sure what his influence is at the moment. But here's the more important question. If it was a kind of non-negotiable teacher action that you'll have a student-engaged classroom, then who's influencing him to get rid of that? To get rid of a classroom that'll look like that? Where's the fellow teacher kind of saying, no, we don't teach. That happens to be an Algebra 1 class. We don't teach algebra that way here. Who's telling him that? Where's the department chair or the district coordinator or the math coach, supervisor, telling him, you know, yeah, let me help you. Let me influence. And what we don't know, I mean, I don't really know his whole story. Maybe he just doesn't want to. Maybe they've tried. And he's just, no, I like my classroom like this. It's easier. He doesn't want to be influenced. I mean, right? We don't really know what's going on and why the classroom's allowed to have the desk shoved up in the back of the room and they're sitting in rows. And most, in fact, when you see the whole picture, there's a few, just a few kids engaged. So it's just an interesting question of where are the other adults who sort of really should have responsibility for influencing his actions? What are they doing? And why aren't they owning his issues and his problems? That's an interesting question. So is influential leadership important? I would argue yes. Leadership qualities such as vision, energy, relational intelligence, positive communication, a high level of noticing quotient, noticing what's going on in that guy's classroom, witness, tough empathy, humility of self, passion, truth, and action, they all really matter. So now how do we do it? I even thought, would you like to be led by you? No. Well, that's not good. I mean, at least we should start with us. We'd like to be led by ourselves. You know, that'd be kind of good. All right, well, change the way you change minds. I had to paraphrase this from Will Rogers. There are three kinds of people. One that learn by reading, a few learn by observation. The rest of them have to touch the electrical fence. But this says a lot, quite honestly, about how we influence others towards the actions we want them to take on. The actions of prime, let's say. So, for example, I could say, you know what, we really want to have high-quality exams in our school. We're going to write high-quality exams at our grade level or in our course. And so here's some articles on it and some examples of what it looks like. Why don't you read up on this and do it? And there are actually a few of your teachers. That will be all the influence you need to do. They're like, okay, I got it. But very few. There are a few that you could say, you know, here, why don't you watch me write some of my tests? Here's what I think a high-quality exam looks like. And my oldest daughter is an 8th-grade math teacher, and the first time she got done with her Chapter 1 test, or she got done with Chapter 1, she had to write her exam. And she came to me, she was living home with us before she got married. She came to me and she said, Dad, you know, would you help me write my first Chapter 1 test? So we got out the test generator, I gave her something that I'd written once about a high-quality exam. And she's like, Dad, I don't need that. And she goes, I just need the test tomorrow. Would you help me write the test? Like, okay. And then I'm thinking, why does she need it tomorrow? Why wasn't it written before the chapter started? But I didn't ask her that. She was a first-year teacher. It's like, okay, you know, it's my kid. So, but what's interesting is maybe she was able to learn that by observation and working with me. But I don't know if that stuck or not. You know, I didn't start monitoring all of her tests. Although I wanted to. And the rest of them have to, you know, like, do it. They just got to start getting in there and experiencing it. Now, this is an important message for what we discover from the influence research, as you'll see in just a minute. Here is really, though, the question that has to be asked first. And this then explains why, 2 hours after Prime was presented, this then became an issue for me. Because quite honestly, when we were developing Prime, it wasn't of interest to me to say, okay, how are we going to get it to then get everyone to get it to happen? It was more of an interest to me of what the heck are the vital behaviors we want teachers to be doing in the first place? The 12 things. You know, the 12 indicators in Prime. It was like, what are the vital teacher behaviors that I would stake my life as a leader on? And until we know that, we don't really know what our influence is. Our influence is random. You know, Katie Haycock said it really well. You get really intentional about what you want done. And you don't let it go. You hang on for dear life. And you make it happen. So the question that you and I have to answer in any given leadership year is, what are those vital behaviors going to be? And so I want you to just do this, just be real quick. Give you a minute or two to do it. Just with a shoulder partner, one other person. Just kind of say, in my current leadership kind of sphere, whatever my job is, this is a vital behavior that I make sure happens with everyone that I try to influence. Just give them one. You probably have more than one, but just give them one, okay? One vital behavior, a vital teacher behavior that you just say, I stake my entire legacy as a leader on. And if they're not doing it, I have failed as my job as a teacher leader, as a leader of teachers, okay? One vital behavior. Go. Okay? All right, got a sense of what that is? And I think, if you know, you probably have more than one. I can tell you, most of my leadership career in mathematics education, I've been about 5 vital behaviors, basically, myself personally, that, like, you know, just were critical to me toward influencing others and trying to get them to come on board with us, you know, in the same direction as I thought it would benefit and apply for kids. So, but keep that vital teacher behavior in mind, like that example in your mind, as we go through this. So that's important first, because how can we have an influential voice if we don't know what it is we're trying to influence people toward? And what that, and then what we would need to do that. And that's kind of what the bridge I want to just cross. Whatever that vital behavior was, do you have teachers you're trying to lead and they're not doing that vital behavior? Vital behavior, relevant, meaningful curriculum. We will actually plan lessons in our school that will be relevant and meaningful and culturally diverse for every child in our third grade, in our seventh grade pre-algebra class, in our sophomore geometry class. We will do that. And you have teachers who aren't doing it. Well, why not? You're supposed to be influencing them to get it done. You've said it's a vital behavior. You've probably told them it's a vital behavior. Maybe you haven't said it exactly like that, but you've done things that demonstrate it's a vital, and they're not doing it. And so obviously they aren't being influenced by you. They don't really care about what you have to say. Right? I mean, it's kind of, well, let's see how that plays out. We are better at coping, actually, than exerting influence. Let me give you an example. Early on in my career, and still, a vital teacher behavior that I was passionate about in myself, as in terms of modeling it, and in terms of those I was leading, was the idea of writing and using high-quality exams. To the point that we did a ton of staff development, a ton of reading on this, a ton of training. I did led a lot of it myself. I got a lot of got other people in to do it. We talked about it. We read stuff. We worked on it. We practiced writing high quality exams. I mean, I was so passionate about this. I made sure it was a major part of our training and professional development. I was like, you know, this is critical for what's best for kids. We have to have exams, you know, that assess children in both, drill and practice as well as higher order cognitive skills. Higher cognitive demand tasks have to be assessed. We have to even assess, you know, sort of their sense of reasoning and be willing to deal with the issues that come from that. All of that was part of our stuff. We even did practical things like I actually made a rule that said you could never, ever use the book test that came with the books. Absolutely not. That would be considered malpractice for that vital behavior. Because it is. Right? I mean, you know that. If you actually use a book, there's no room to actually write the problems and do the answers. And not how, you know, there's parts of it you haven't even taught or it's not relevant to your local curriculum. So that was a big rule we had as a way to sort of enact this. And you know, and as people new to our school culture joined us and kind of came into our, you know, it was vital behavior. We don't accept handwritten tests. You can't even write it. You have to like type up your test. If you don't know how to type, then we're going to help you learn. You don't know how to use math type, we'll help you learn. Right? All of that. Huge vital behavior, and there was a lot of things I did to try to influence people toward that. And yet, as you can imagine, I had teachers on my own staff that were not writing and using high-quality exams. In fact, sometimes I would find out by surprise. You know, does that ever happen to you? And you're like going, how could this happen? 5 years after I started as a director of mathematics and science in my district, 5 years after I started, in the early fall, I get a memo from our copy center. And our copy center had a rule that the department chairs or division directors, like I was, had to sign off. If it was for more than 500 copies, you had to sign off. If a teacher wanted more than 500 copies of something, you had to just sign off. And they had a request for 9,000 copies. So they sent it back to me saying, is this okay? The 9,000 copies was for this particular teacher's exams for the entire year. It was September. And this particular teacher was running off his exams for the entire year. And they were all the book test exams. Uh-huh. Obviously, in 5 years, I hadn't influenced him towards a vital behavior of the organization, you know, that, right? I'd somehow missed. And I took it very personally, and you'll see why as we kind of look at the research. So here's what we find out. First of all, there are factors influencing whether people will choose to enact a vital behavior. So whatever you said was your vital behavior, that you said, I want everyone doing this, Not just me, but everyone that I'm influencing, everyone that's in my sphere of leadership. So there are factors influence whether people choose it. Those two factors simply are, one, to them now, or whether or not they'll allow you to influence them towards it. Number one, is it worth it to me to do it? And two, can I do it? And I will tell you, in this particular instance, 5 years later, I had failed at helping this individual on both of these counts. As soon as I read this, I said, well, no wonder he wasn't doing it. Now, I guarantee, because as you'll see in the rest of the story as we move through this session, because it clearly wasn't worth it to him for so many right reasons in his world. It'll take time. You can't just write up tests like that. You know how fast it is to run off a book test? Very fast, unless you make the mistake of asking for all of them at once and your director finds out. You know. But it's very fast. So it's not worth it to me to actually take all that time. I've got other things I've got to get done. Right? Is what that person's thinking. Also, can I do it? It took me a long time to find that out, though, because this person tried to hide that for a long time, that he actually really couldn't do it. And when we, by the way, equity indicator number 3, which says that you and I are responsible for removing teacher isolation and forcing teachers to work in collaborative teams, right? So that we get rid of the inequity of the assessment writing practices and all that. Well, it's hard to hide when you have to work with other adults. It's hard to hide when you're not allowed to work in isolation anymore. But, you know, back in those days, we didn't know that. We weren't like it is now in 2009. So those questions have to be answered. So I want you to think about this just for a second. Not out loud. Well, I don't think you think out loud. But anyway, so think about that vital behavior you just said. Do you have someone who's not doing it? Can you think of someone that's kind of struggling to get it done? Got it? Kind of put that person, write down their name if you have to. Or a lot of someone's, maybe. And ask yourself, how would they answer these? Not how would you answer them. Of course it's worth it to you. It's why it's one of your vital behaviors. But is it worth it to them to do what you're asking? And two, can they really do it? Do they have confidence to do it? What's their level of confidence? I'll just give you another quick example of this. Another vital behavior, many of us on my staff, around me, and in math and science, our math and science teachers, early on said, we will make a 100% commitment to the integration of technology in all of our courses, grades 6, 12. And that technology meant a lot of different things. Sometimes it meant graphing calculators, sometimes it meant calculators, sometimes it meant other kinds of software. But that every child would experience from grade 6, 12 on in math and science a technology experience in their classroom. We would not let that go. That was a vital behavior, integration of technology. We would even write all our exams and rechange them so that they would have calculator portions and non-calculator portions. So kids would literally be required to have to learn how to use it. And you know how long it took to get that vital behavior embedded into the culture where people would really all do it, be influenced and say, yeah, that's a vital behavior I believe in too? What's interesting about it was I had one primary resistor. Do you have any people like this? Primary resistor who also was a influential voice. Not necessarily a positive influential voice, but you know, you got people like that, and they're kind of edgy, and they're always kind of pushing against what you're trying to get people to move to. And so I had a person like this, and I think for her, definitely the question of is it worth it? Absolutely not. Having to create lessons that were going to integrate technology, having to actually use the technology, having to kind of recreate and not use the same, back then, transparencies she'd used the year before, absolutely not. Not worth it. Are you kidding me? Why would I go through all that work? You guys don't pay me enough to go through all that work. Yeah, that's what she said. Which is another interesting part of this, too, about extrinsic motivation versus intrinsic. But anyway. So, I did something just really, really sneaky. And also, can I do it? I don't think this person felt that way because often, because I was forcing her to do it, even though she didn't want to, I forced her to do it. Like, but I would go into her classroom with her and teach it with her. And I would literally, like the period before, like help her see how to do it. And I just was like, you're going to figure this out, and I'm not letting go until you do. You will hate me. If you hate me, you hate me. But this is what's best for our children. So I'm losing the battle. I mean, clearly I'm not winning. And so I did something really, really, really sneaky, which was I sent this person to a technology conference, but it was a trainer of trainers conference. Yeah, so meaning that she had to come back and train all the rest of us on what she learned on the technology that we wanted to integrate in. Yeah, and there you go. So you never know. There's always ways to move people along. So what's the most common tool that we use to persuade people or influence them? What the research tells us is verbal persuasion. You could even argue, for some of you sitting here, that just with my one story this morning, I've kind of created a motivating thought for you to go, yeah, I better go home and make sure I guarantee high quality exams. I've forgotten about that one. You know, and you might be persuaded by my words. But generally, it's a tool that fails because verbal persuasion never works if people don't trust, one, our knowledge about what we're talking about, or two, our motives. Well, why did I feel so passionate about beginning to develop high-quality exams? Is it because I wanted to be great? Is it all about me? What's my motive in doing that? Is critical for people to understand who tend to resist your influence. They need to know. They need to be able to trust. Why are you really doing this? Why is that such a vital behavior? And I, you know, early, you know, for me, it was always back to the kids, always, because we have a lot of evidence that if we do this, student achievement will go up. It's why our research papers aren't just nice paper, our position papers, they're actually steeped in the research that we know says those things will work. But what's interesting is that there's got to be a trust that your motives are good. You know, and I think that takes time sometimes with people you're trying to influence. So the knowledge motive thing, kind of keep that there, because knowledge is stage one leadership. You know, on the integration technology vital behavior, I didn't have to know all the technology, but I had to know what I wanted to be the result of the use of the technology. Now, I didn't have to be the trainer on all the technology. I didn't have to be the expert on it. In fact, there's some people sitting in this room who I brought into my school to help us with that goal. Because I wasn't, you know, you don't have to be top dog and everything, but what you got to do is be able to understand or have the knowledge of this is what it'll look like if we get there, right? So keep that in mind. Those two things are really important. And I see knowledge as stage one growth for us, you know, in all these vital behaviors that we want. You know, even the thing you listed just now as your vital behavior, are you know, what is your sort of ability, just like when you talk. See, here's another thing too. Every one of you, I bet, were great classroom teachers. Those of you that are no longer teaching, you're doing more leadership supervisory jobs of some kind with less teaching in it. I bet you were great classroom teachers. And then we get these jobs, and it's like we stop teaching. You never stop teaching. It's like, okay, so what? How do you teach the vital behavior so that it's clear to those you're trying to influence? And I can't do that unless I have pretty good knowledge of it. Like, for example, I could not have given this talk a year ago. It wasn't even in my knowledge base. I'd never even heard of it. I was like, I don't know, I just tried to influence by telling you, get it done and shut up. that worked. So anyway, you get the idea. So knowledge and motives. Verbal persuasion not doesn't work. In fact, here's the catch. When it comes to resistant problems that you have in your school right now, verbal persuasion rarely works. Isn't that hysterical? I mean, rarely works. Rarely will my talking to this teacher and saying, you know, you really need to write a high quality exam. Okay, great. You know, persistent problem for 5 years. I haven't been able to get him to change. All of a sudden now, just my words will somehow magically make him do it. People are not going to give up what constitutes an important window in their view of self because of a well-turned phrase for me or you. This teacher I had who was not doing a vital teacher behavior in writing high quality exams, obviously nothing I had said to him for 5 years had turned him over yet to getting it done, because it wasn't relevant to his world. In fact, Resistors don't merely believe you are wrong. They need you to be wrong. Because if you're right, man, now I got to start writing good tests, and that's going to take more time, and I won't have as much time to do this other stuff, and I'll have to, you know, stop doing these things, and I'll have to begin to learn about that. And, oh man, you're just messing with my world. And since the final judge exists in their own head, you and I lose every time. I'd lost with this teacher for 5 years. So, what do we know? And by the way, one of the things I started to learn then was, well, why do people resist? You may know this innately anyway, but let me share with you what I found out in reading through all this. Number one, people resist. Do you have resistors, or am I making this up? It's only me. Okay, good. So people resist. Some people resist because they're afraid they're going to disappoint you or someone else or themselves. If I try to write high quality exams and they're not very good, then people are just going to say I'm not very good. It's like there's this fear of disappointment. And the question becomes, of course, how can we address that? How do we address fear of disappointment, you know, in terms of creating a safe way for people to risk? Right. Another one that happens is there's it's referred to as the cynic. The cynic tends to have a fear of accepting responsibility. Like if I really got in and did this and started writing high quality exams, I'd be responsible for my kids in a low level geometry class actually learning high cognitive demand tests. If I actually embrace it and they still don't learn it, it might be my fault. But if I don't do it, then I don't have to worry about it. So people who just don't want to be held accountable. And then there's those that just oppose what you want to influence, you know, mainly just because they want the power to do it their way. And if they give in to you, that's like they're allowing you to influence them. So how do we do it then? Well, the great persuader, according to everything I've read, is personal experience. That by far the greatest way to begin to influence people towards the vital behavior that you want is to get them into it and just, it's like throw them in the pool and watch them swim. Just get them in and maybe throw them a life raft occasionally. But, you know, it's like, it's not telling them this will work. It's like making them do it so that it's like touching the electric fence. They need to touch the electric fence. When trying to lead others to change long-established views, we should abandon verbal persuasion and opt for a real-life experience. Nothing changes a mind like actual data. And those of you at the opening session yesterday, for example, you had to admit, that was pretty hard, wasn't it? Who are the high school folks in here? Yeah. Tough to walk out of there feeling real good. You know, it's not like we're not trying, but man, we got work to do. Well, what's interesting with this, in my mind, so let me pick up the story now. So this guy who put in all these tests and was violating a vital behavior, clearly my persuasion had not worked. Clearly the things I showed him had not worked. Clearly the two or three times before where I told him I didn't ever want book tests used again hadn't worked. Because, you know, so I'm feeling pretty bad about that. But anyway, in the meantime, I'm trying to decide what to do about this person and what to say. While I'm waiting to do that, another teacher comes in and says, "Did you hear what this teacher did?" Well, I'm like the boss, so you know I can't really say or not say, you know, what I know or don't know. But here was the condemning thing for all of us as leaders: you would never let us get away with that. Why are you letting him get away with that? That's what happens to us when we ignore vital behaviors we said we're going to have high quality exams, and now I got a few teachers that aren't doing it. It starts to reflect on your own leadership. So I said, you know, why don't you go talk to him? You know, you're so concerned. You know, you go. Be glad to have you talk to him. Well, here's what happened. I pulled him in, we talked. And I didn't realize this is what I was doing, but I basically said to him, you know, clearly you don't get this yet after 5 years of working on it. And I said, so here's what we're going to do. This is unacceptable. Can't do it. I didn't say we have a vital behavior, but I did say we have a value. You know, we have a value here in this school that we will write high quality exams. I said, and I actually kind of seeing this now in retrospect, I actually asked him in that interview or that whatever that was, conference, I said, do you even know how to write them? Because I said, why are you using these tests? I said, you know that we're not supposed to do that, right? That we've kind of agreed, or at least, you know, it's not a written rule or anything, but we've said that we'll have high quality. And he said, yeah. He said, but and he said, but they're from the book. Well, we were using a book that I'm part of. So he said, well, they're from your book. I thought they'd be good. And I was like, that won't work. So, yeah, you get it. So I just said to him, look, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to help you write every one of your exams this year. I'm going to teach you how to do this personally. We'll experience it together. And I'm also going to pair you up with another teacher of the same of that course. And she'll be kind of your kind of reflective, safe person to do this with. Because when it's with me, it's going to be accountability time. But when it's with her, it can just be to kind of get it work done. And every single one of your tests are going to have to run through me, and you're going to have to write them all before. And that was back before we were kind of in the day of working all together with the same, kind of writing our tests and working together in a collegial way on it. The point is, abandon verbal persuasion. Stop trying to talk them into it and opt out for a real life experience. Touching the electric fence began to change his lens. He didn't like it. You know, I don't know if he still felt it was worth it, although with time, you know, I think it grew. And at the time, I didn't know. Now, here's what I want to tell you. I'm going to tell you the end of the story. Fast forward 12 years later, he is retiring. He comes up to me at his retirement, and he says, I just want you to know. And, I mean, this is a person that we had a lot of this going on throughout the whole time I was trying to influence him. He came up to me and said, I just want you to know. You had the greatest impact on my teaching career. I'm thinking like, I thought you hated me. He goes, no. He goes, you know, I just didn't want you to know that I was starting to like what you were telling me. You know? And I'm like, you know, because seriously, the battles I had with this person. But the real life experiences, I think, really can turn it. So that's one thing we know. Create an experience that will get them to do it. Now, a lot of what I'm talking about comes from this book called Influencer. Actually, as an NCSM board, we like the book so much, we're actually using it for our summer reading. Where everybody got a copy, they're reading it, and have to come to our summer retreat prepared to respond to it and different issues within it. And it's called Influencer, The Power to Change Anything. And it's really got a lot of great ideas, I think, for us as leaders to kind of figure out how do we lead people towards the things we want them to do. And one of the things they really talk about is to use stories to change minds. Sometimes you can't get the person to experience it, so what you do is use a story to help them understand it. A story of change, a story of impact. Here would be an example of this. I'm going to tell you a story right now that is a way I try to influence people to understand the vital importance of this teaching, this being a teaching behavior. As you know, equity indicator number 3 is about working together in collaborative communities, interdependently, teachers no longer work in isolation. I mentioned right up top, right? So here's the Now, I could talk to you about that, and it would be nice, and I could try to persuade you with some words and just be like falling asleep. Or you could still maybe fall asleep, but I could tell a story, and that's true. And remember what I did? If you saw the opening, I said every story has 3 things to it. It has passion, it has truth, and it has action, right? That's every story. Keep thinking of that the rest of your life. Passion, truth, action. So there should be passion about that vital behavior. If you're not passionate about that vital behavior, your people you're trying to influence will never catch it. 2, there should be truth. You know, you shouldn't be asking people or influencing them things that aren't going to make life better. If you're influencing them towards like yucky things, I wouldn't follow you either. And then 3, there has to be like a sense of like commitment, like a sense that there actually is action. So this is all true. I mean, what I'm about to tell you is true, even though you're going to say, oh, you must be a terrible father. Okay? So, and if some of you have heard this particular story, I apologize, but it's vital to the message. All right, so here it is. My oldest daughter, 8th grade math teacher, right? Awesome. Comes home to live with us. First week of school, I'm like, can I help you with your lesson plans? Can I show you how to write a good one? Like, you know, kids need to be active and they need to be doing this. And here's how you get immediate time on task. And here's how you get closure. Let me help you. Dad, I got it. Just leave me alone. So I'm like, okay. But we get to that point that I described earlier where I help her write her first test. And when we got to the end of the writing of that test, I asked her just a very, very simple question. She was teaching eighth grade, you know, like pre-algebra and algebra, and there were, and it was, this was her algebra test. And so we get to the end of the test. I think it's pretty good. It looks like a high quality. I mean, I'm kind of pleased with it. You know, I think we did okay. And I just said to her, I said, well, what are the other two eighth grade math teachers doing? What's their chapter one test look like? And she said, well, I don't know, Dad. I haven't even talked to them yet. I said, what? You're 2 weeks into the school year. You haven't talked to the other two math. Well, you know, we're not set up that way. And, you know, I really haven't had time. And I said, well, you need to talk to those other two math teachers. And she said, well, you know, we really don't do that. And I said, well, I want to. Well, okay, here it is. Is this test too hard or too easy? Is it the right level of rigor for what's expected in this school? She's like, Dad, I'm, you know, she's just looking at me like, I don't know. You know, like, you know, I'm asking, obviously, a 21-year-old the wrong questions. So, but I'm getting more passionate and kind of, you know, stirred up. And I said, well, we need to go talk to your principal. And her school's like on the way to my school. So I went right, I followed her right to work. And I came into the school with her. And we sat down in front of the principal. And I asked him a very simple question. I said, what is your expectation for rigor in mathematics assessments in this school? And he couldn't tell me. And I said, well, let's get the other two math teachers down here and find out. So we got the other two math. And I said, and make them bring their chapter one tests. So they bring their chapter one tests down. They come down. And I have to tell you, I did know the teachers. And their tests were pretty good. I mean, they were decent. And I just looked at one of them and I said, look at this test. Is it any good or not? Does this match your standard of rigor for 8th grade Algebra 1, Chapter 1 expectations in this school or not? Is she even close? And then they're kind of looking. And then I said, and you guys should be ashamed of yourselves. She's a first-year teacher. She knows nothing. And of course, she's sitting there the whole time. Yeah, it took about a year to forgive me. But I said, she's a first-year teacher. She doesn't know anything. I said, why aren't you helping her? Why aren't you guiding her? Why aren't you giving her your stuff? Why aren't you showing her how to write a test? I said, I don't get it. How is she supposed to learn this stuff? You know, not every new teacher has a math dad at home. Oh, I was so upset. And I said, this is unacceptable. This cannot happen. You are not going to let my daughter go through her first year of teaching, learning that the way you learn how to teach is to do it all by yourself. And you have to figure it all out by yourself. And then 10 years from now, she's not going to want to work with anybody because she's learned how to do it all by herself. We are not going to let that happen here. And I said, it's the principal. I said, you got to change that. I said, I want her working with these other two teachers. I want time for them at least once a week. And the guy's like, oh, why did I hire her? You know. But here's the point. They eventually became a collaborative team. They started writing all their tests together. They started working together on a lot of these vital behaviors of quality tests. Within a short period of time, 3-4 years, they actually retired, and she kind of became now like the knowledge voice of the department. I mean, what if that hadn't happened? Where would that school be today? You know? And so what's fascinating to me is just that that is a story that makes the point about if we don't get teachers to collaborate and work together around certain vital behaviors, then the inconsistency of rigor will just kill the kids. And they'll all pass on to the next level, widely differently prepared. And that's not healthy. So, but the story makes it come alive better than if we don't use the story. Now, I still don't know if you're persuaded or not. You know, I'd have to come to your school and dig in with you to see if you really would take action. But the result of that story is that there was passion, mine in the beginning, truth about what we know is a good practice, and then eventually action on their part. All right, anyway. Best practice in equitable student learning experiences trumps the student inequities created by teacher isolation. One of the things that I feel pretty strong about is that is a kind of a vital teaching behavior then. Yes, you might have a self-interest in autonomy and not working with others, but sorry, that's not strong enough for what our better and bigger vital teacher behaviors are. There's always a competing interest. We have to help merge that process. So there's three things that Kerry Patterson and his group, if you know the book Crucial Conversations, it's a smaller red book, great book, right? Well, it's the same author, same group that wrote this book. And in it, he says, so what do we do to try to influence? Three things. Number one, kind of understand what the personal motivation is in those people. You know, so while when you go back and you're thinking about this vital behavior, and you've got a lot of people that, by the way, your words were fine. What you said, God, they were right with you. But you've got this other kind of group that's quite, not quite there yet. When, if you want to influence them too, then one of the things you have to do is figure out how do you make the undesirable, writing a high quality test when it'd be so much easier just to run the darn book test, how do you make it desirable? That is a first, not your word, not your, you know, don't tell me I'm supposed to write high quality tests. How could you make that act desirable for me? Like, why would that be something that eventually I would just want to do it? So that's, and you know what? You don't know until you ask. Often we kind of ignore our resistors, but we got to lean into them. So imagine yourself leaning into that person. But stage one leadership, so make the undesirable desirable. How do we kind of motivate ourselves? And how do we even understand that idea of why? Because you know what, quite honestly, if I can't make the writing of high quality exams a desirable activity by my staff, they won't do it. It won't be, I won't be able to influence them to it. Two, they recommend social motivation. And that's kind of where we feel so strongly about the stage two leadership. There's this kind of harnessing of peer pressure and finding strength in numbers. You know, like eventually, if you get 8 out of, you know, 3 out of 13 people doing it, and then 10 out of 13 people, and eventually the last 3 is okay, we give. You know, so there's this kind of peer pressure and peer leadership that's so important. Michael Fullan calls it lateral accountability, that we all kind of take care of each other. That's why we are asking teachers now to think bigger than themselves and their classrooms. The goal today for us is to say to teachers, don't drive to work and think about your third grade class. Drive to work and think about all the third grade kids and how are we helping them learn the mathematics, all of them learn it. Don't drive to work and think about your algebra sections, your 3 sections of algebra. Drive to work and think about how are all the kids learning algebra. You must add, there has to be this peer pressure and support, and that will be far greater than anything you and I can do with our words to get that. If there's peer pressure to write high quality exams, it'll be done. It'll happen. So then what we got to do is sit there and go, okay, how do I create the peer pressure? You know, how can I get that going? How can I get people to begin to, not in a bad way, pressure, you know, but in a good way, come together. And the third thing is structural motivation. Design rewards and demand accountability. There's a lot to this, and if you get the book, you can read the chapters and kind of get into it. But essentially here, this would mean things like, with my oldest daughter's situation, the principal had to change the way the math teachers did their schedule so they could have that 2 hours a week every week to be there. There had to be structural motivation for me to get it done. If you're going to ask me to do it on Saturdays or do it after school or before, I'm not going to get involved. But if you create a structure that sort of requires, you know, provides the opportunity for me to do it, then it would happen. We tend to cope better than we do influence. Real quick, I had a teacher who was towards the end of his career, and it wasn't going well. In fact, it was going so poorly that I was getting constant parent requests to move kids out of his classes. I was getting constant, and I was doing it, so now we had some classes way overloaded, and his classes were, so now his peers are resenting him. He was not happy, his kids weren't happy, he was angry with his life. And I kind of was at a place with him where I was just like, it's just 2 more years. I think I can make it. If he can make it. And I don't know what happened, but somewhere, something inside of me said, not good enough. And I brought him in. I actually had done a 3-day evaluation, because that's how we do them in our schools. So, you know, pre-conference, 3 days of visits. And after the third day, it was so bad. I was just like, I don't even know what I'm going to say. It was just, I was like, I don't even think I can write this up. And so what happened was, I brought him into my office and I just said, look, let's not even talk about this. I said, I want you to write down a piece of paper. Can you remember one time in your life where you actually enjoyed teaching? Was there ever a moment when you got into this business and you enjoyed it? You liked kids, you liked math. You know, and he started, you know, and he, you know, he's kind of a tough, little bit of a tough guy, and you didn't really want to do it. I said, just take a minute, just write it out. So he did. He started writing it out, and he started to cry. I was like, okay, this is good, you know, breakthrough. But here's what's interesting. So it was on a Friday, because I also had set up the meeting on a Friday, like at the end of the day, right? So I wouldn't have to face them for a couple of days. Like, have you ever done that? So, you know, you wouldn't have to really deal with it till Monday. You know, okay, I'll tell you this, and then we'll all run. You know, so he comes in on Monday. We kind of re-meet. I'd given him some tags. I said, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write down five essential requirements you need to finish well, to have a great final 2 years. What would you need? And I'm going to write down five too. And we'll look at our list and we'll come up with a plan for a great finish. And he was like, all right, I'll try to do that. So he came together. We put together that plan. He got going. The plan I would say it wasn't great for the last 2 years, but it was better than where it would have gone. And so I think as leaders, that's part of what we have to do. We have to provide that kind of accountability, but it can be done in a way that's supportive and not just under pressure. And final recommendations they make is, number one, as a leader, you must become an opinion leader. If you're not the opinion leader in your department or in your area of leadership or in your school or your grade level or whatever your job is or your university, if you're not an opinion leader, if your knowledge isn't positive and trustworthy, then someone else is. I'll guarantee it. In fact, I think I could come to any of your school or districts or campuses or whatever and sit in on a couple of your meetings, and pretty quickly I'd know exactly who your opinion leaders are. And I would hope you'd be one of them. Because if you're not, you're not going to win the battle. They're going to win the battle because they're the opinion leaders. You know, and here's another secret. When you want to influence the whole group, first thing you do is go talk to the opinion leaders and make sure you got them on board privately before you ever say anything publicly. That's a smart thing to do. Like, you kind of know who if I just get them over, then I think the rest of you, right? Okay, so knowledge and trustworthy. Two, make undiscussables discussable. And until I said to my group, writing high quality exams, and the reality is many of you do not. I have lots of evidence of bad exams in the school. I have many examples, and no one wanted to talk about it. So you got to be willing to discuss the undiscussables, whatever are kind of, you know, the things that need to be kind of addressed, but no one wanting to do it because somebody's feelings will get hurt. All right, so good luck with that. And then choose extrinsic rewards second, first to connecting to vital behaviors. I'm going to give you an example with my 7th grade daughter to make this point. The influence research says we tend to make extrinsic rewards first, and then people no longer are motivated by the vital behavior. I'll give you an example where this could have turned on me. So we have a daughter that's in 7th grade. She's in like pre-AP classes. She's a pretty good kid. I mean, you know, she's decent. She actually does homework and stuff. So, we had told her, typical parents will do, if you get straight A's the entire year in all your courses, not one B, we'll let you choose your own cell phone at the end of the year. And for a 7th grader, you might as well just give them the world. Within certain financial limits. So she's been highly motivated by that all year. It's been weird. But I actually asked her in the car the other day. I said, Anna, tell me the truth. If you knew that cell phone wasn't going to be there in the next 9 weeks, you know, if you still got straight, would you still have worked as hard as you could to get those A's? That's an important point, right? Like, is she just doing it for that extrinsic motivation, or does she actually see the vital behavior of good grades will pay off later on? You know, and she's 12, so what can a 12-year-old know anyway? But, you know, you get the idea. So it's the same thing here. It's great to have rewards. It's great to celebrate. It's great to do. But first, people have to connect the action to a vital behavior. Like celebrating that. And so, for example, it's April. All of you are going to have end-of-the-year celebrations, right? You're going to have celebrations in June, end of May, June, whatever. I would beg you to tie your celebrations to the essential and vital behaviors of that you believe in, that you want to see happening. Don't celebrate that somebody got 20 years in. I mean, okay, maybe you have to, but being older isn't like, you know, a vital behavior. Writing high-quality exams is. Celebrate your teacher teams that are doing that, or whatever you think the vital behaviors are. I mean, I don't, you know, you've got to figure that out. But whatever those things are, notice them and celebrate the heck out of them is a very powerful way to influence others to say, oh, I actually had, I'm not kidding, So we do that all the time in our district. And I had a teacher come up to me once, this is about 4 or 5 years ago now, and she said, you know, Tim, you celebrate a lot of people, a lot of stuff. She goes, I've never been called up on the stage. And I just said to her, in a very kind way, this is going to sound a little harsh, I said, look, I didn't know the word vital behaviors back then. I just said, if you do something at some point that represents our values, because that's what we call it, our values, then I guarantee you, you'll come up. But you haven't so far. So, you know, you got to get there. I don't think that's what you wanted to hear, but it was an important message that we value those that move towards our vital behavior. So the intrinsic aspect of it. So good luck with that. Two great resources, just so you know, The Power of Full Engagement by James Lehrer and The Power of Story. Both of these are books that you can get right off the shelf, and they're great books for you and I to kind of figure out how to better lead in our schools. And I just would encourage you, it kind of takes you outside of your comfort zone into more about, away from the math, but more towards the leadership aspect of things. They're the books I'm currently reading and sort of being influenced by. And then I just want to leave you with this phrase. When we move on, people don't remember us for what we do for ourselves. They remember us for what we do for them. They are the inheritors of our work. And the best thing that you can do, I think, in terms of what our hope is for solving some of the problems that Katie talked about, I think is to kind of think about, all right, how am I influencing them towards these vital behaviors in a way that works well beyond just my words? And hopefully some of the things we talked about today plant some seeds of ideas that will be useful for you. So it's our hope, it's our legacy, it's all rests in your hands. So good luck. Thank you so much for coming to this session. Thank you.